Old paths, where the good way is. Timeless truth from the Bible, Christian teaching, thought and meditations from prior times, read by missionary to Africa, James Robinette.
The Leading of the Holy Spirit by A.W. Pink, 1886 through 1952. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. Romans 8, verse 14. This verse presents to us another aspect of the varied work of the blessed Holy Spirit. In addition to all his other functions, he performs the office of guide unto the godly. Nor is this peculiar to the present dispensation. He so ministered during the Old Testament times. This is brought out clearly in Isaiah 63. Where is he that brought them up out of the sea with the shepherd of his flock? Where is he that put his Holy Spirit within him, that led them by the right hand of Moses with his glorious arm, dividing the water before them to make himself an everlasting name, that led them through the deep as an horse in the wilderness, that they should not stumble? As a beast goeth down into the valley, the Spirit of the Lord caused him to rest. So didst thou lead thy people to make thyself a glorious name. Verses 11 through 14. Moses was no more able by his own power to induce the Hebrews to pass between the divided waters of the Red Sea and to cross the trackless desert than by the mere extending of the rod he could divide those waters. Moses was simply the human instrument. The Holy Spirit was the efficient agent. In the above passage, we have more than a hint of how the Holy Spirit leads. It is by means of an inward impulse as well as by external directions. Among his comments upon Romans 8, verse 14, Matthew Henry says, "Led by the Spirit as a scholar in his learning is led by his tutor, as a traveler in his journey is led by his guide, as a soldier in his engagements is led by his captain." But such analogies are inadequate, for they present only the external side, leaving out of the account the internal operations of the Spirit, which are even more essential. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. Jeremiah 10, verse 23. By nature, we are not only ignorant of God's way, but reluctant to walk therein, even when it is shown us. And therefore, we find the church praying, "Draw me, we will run after thee." Song 1, verse 4. Ah, we never seek unto God, still less run after him, till we are divinely drawn. This humbling truth was well understood by David of old. First he prayed, "Teach me, O Lord, the way of thy statutes. Give me understanding." Psalm 119, verses 33 and 34. But second, he realized that something more than divine illumination was needed by him. Therefore did he add, "Make me go in the path of thy commandments. Incline my heart unto thy testimonies," verses 35 and 36. By nature, our hearts are averse from God and holiness. We can be worldly of ourselves, but we cannot be heavenly of ourselves. The power of sin lies in the love of it, and it is only as our affections are divinely drawn unto things above that we are delivered from sin's dominion. Moreover, our wills are perverse, and only as supernatural grace is brought to bear upon them are they inclined Godwards. Thus, to be led by the Spirit of God is to be governed by him from within, to be subject unto his secret but real impulses or strivings. Not only are our hearts inclined by nature unto temporal, material, worldly, and evil things, rather than unto eternal, spiritually, heavenly, and holy things, but they are by inveterate custom too. As soon as we are born, we follow the bent of our natural appetites, and the first few years of our life are governed merely by sense. And the pleasures begotten by gratifying our senses become deeply ingrained in us. Moreover, by constant living in the world and long contact with material things, the tendency increases upon us and we become more strongly settled in a worldly frame. Can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? Then may ye also do good that are accustomed to do evil. Jeremiah 13, verse 23. Custom becomes a second nature to us. The more we follow a certain course of life, the more we delight in it, and we are only weaned from it with very great difficulty. Natural lusts and appetites being born and bred in us from infancy continue to cry out for indulgence and satisfaction. The will has become bent to a carnal course, and the heart craves material pleasures. Hence, when the claims of God are presented to us, when the interests of our souls and the things of eternity are brought before us, when the beauty of holiness is presented to our view, they find our wills already biased in the contrary direction, and our heart prepossessed with other inclinations, which by reason of long indulgence bind us to them. The heart being deeply engaged with and delighting in temporal and worldly things is quite unable to respond to the dictates of reason and set itself upon that which is heavenly and divine. And even the voice of conscience is unheeded by the soul, which prefers the insidious lullaby of Satan. Nothing but the almighty power of the Holy Spirit can turn, lead the heart in a contrary direction. Now the heart is inclined toward God when the habitual bent of our affections is more to holiness than to worldly things. As the power of sin lies in the love of it, so it is with indwelling grace. Grace prevails over us when we so love the things of God that the bent of the will and the strength of our affections is carried after them. When the course of our desires and endeavors and the strength and stream of our souls runs out after holiness, then the heart is inclined Godwards. And how is this brought to pass? How does God reduce our rebellious hearts and mold them to the obedience of His will? The answer is by His word and by His Spirit. Or putting it another way, by moral persuasion and by gracious power. And I will put my Spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, Ezekiel 36, verse 27. God does this by combining together invincible might and gentle inducements. God works upon us morally, not physically, because He will preserve our nature and the principles thereof. He does not force us against our wills, but sweetly draws us. He presents weighty reasons, casting into the mind one after another till the scales be turned and then all is made efficacious by His Spirit. Yet this is not a work which He does in the soul once and for all, but is often renewed and repeated, and that because the flesh or sinful nature remains in us unchanged even after regeneration. Therefore, do we need to ask God to continue inclining our hearts toward Himself? This brings us to notice the intimate connection which exists between our present text and the verse immediately preceding it. For if ye live after the flesh, ye shall die. But if ye through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of the body, ye shall live. Romans 8, verse 13. If we yield ourselves to the Spirit's impulses to restrain our evil propensities and our proneness to indulge them, then heaven will be our portion. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. Verse 14. Thus Romans 8, verse 14 is said in confirmation and amplification of verse 13. Only those who are ruled by the Spirit give evidence that they are the sons of God. To be led by the Spirit then means, as the whole context clearly shows, to walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit, verse 4. To mind the things of the Spirit, verse 5. To, through the Spirit, mortify the deeds of the body, verse 13. Suitably did Calvin remark in Romans 8, verse 14, thus the empty boasting of hypocrites is taken away, who without any reason assume the title of sons of God. Thus we are led by the Spirit, both actively and passively. Actively with respect to his prompting, passively on our part as we submit to those promptings. Actively by his pressing upon us the holy requirements of the Scriptures, passively as we yield ourselves unto those requirements. The Spirit is our guide. We must obey his motions. In the immediate context, it is his restraining motives which are in view, moving us to the mortifying of sin. But his leading is not to be restricted to that. His exercises, inviting motives, encouraging us unto the perfecting of holiness, also are existent. And this being guided and governed by the Holy Spirit is an infallible proof that we are living members of God's family. It is the office of Jehovah the Spirit in the covenant of redemption. After he has called the elect out of the world to place himself at their head and undertake their future guidance. He knows the only path which leads to heaven. He knows the difficulties and dangers which beset us, the intricate maze of life's journey, the numerous false routes by which Satan deceives souls, and the proneness of the human heart to follow that which is evil. And therefore does he, in his infinite grace, take charge of those who are strangers and pilgrims in this scene and conduct them safely to the celestial country. Oh, what praise is due unto this heavenly guide. How gladly and thankfully should we submit ourselves unto his directions. How hopeless would we be without him. With what alacrity should we follow his motions and directions. As we have already pointed out, the blessed Spirit of God leads both objectively and subjectively by pointing us to the directive precepts of the Word, that our actions may be regulated thereby, and by secret impulses from within the soul, impressing upon us the course we should follow, the evils to be avoided, the duties to be performed. The Spirit acts upon his own life in the renewed soul. He works in the Christian a right disposition of heart relating to truth and duty. He maintains in the believer a right disposition of mind, preparing and disposing him to attend unto the revealed will of God. He speaks effectually to the conscience, enlightens the understanding, regulates the desires, and orders the conduct of those who submit themselves unto his holy suggestions and overtures. To be led by the Spirit of God is to be under his guidance and government.